From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Seas are rising all over. Extreme weather, too. Bangkok, Jakarta, New Orleans, and other vulnerable cities are building new barriers to the sea. After Superstorm Sandy, New York is considering the same. Giant gates and barricades, huge projects. Armor against changing climate. Is this the way to go? This hour On Point, walling New York off from the raging sea. You can join the conversation. Is it time to build huge storm surge barriers around New York City? Maybe your town, too. Is this the way to go? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We go first to New York for the latest on Sandy's ongoing aftermath and now a new storm, snow and cold, hard rain in the city and beyond. Joining us from New York is Jim Dwyer. He's been covering the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy for the New York Times. Jim, thanks for being here. How many still without power in New York beyond, Jim? Do you know?
Oh, I don't know that kind of number, but I keep hearing things like hundreds of thousands here and there. So it's one of these numbers that is far more than you'd like to even contemplate. But everywhere you go, you find people without electricity in their homes. Some of the big residential apartment buildings in lower Manhattan still don't have power, and they're trying to figure out how to get up and down 50 flights of stairs to empty out refrigerators that are starting to, get pretty gamey after a week without any electricity.
Yeah, to say the least. And how is this new wave of cold and icy rain and even snow, how's that settled down on top of the existing problems? What's it doing to recovery to people who still don't have energy?
It's driving people who had previously tried to hang in their homes without power. It's driving more of them, as I understand it, into shelters. It's a very, very difficult situation, far more, I think, than has really been conveyed so far, far more difficult than has been conveyed so far. The resources here are stretched very thin, and there's a lot of people trying to do stuff, but it's spread over such a huge area, hundreds and hundreds of square miles not only New York City, but Long Island, New Jersey, the coast up and down have really been hit very hard by this. And then inland, again, you have these continuing power problems, which are just shocking to people who thought, well, I'm pretty far away from the coast. I don't have to worry about this.
I mean, here we are going on 10 days after the storm. I've got friends sending me pictures. They're in their houses. No electricity still. Around a little fire, maybe down jackets and stocking caps. And this is almost 10 days later. I mean, is there a kind of post-Katrina face to this? You said we haven't taken it on board yet, that we're just not fully seeing here, Jim?
I think a lot of the real horror or the real displacement of emotionally and physically is still to emerge from it, honestly. There are kids who are not going to be back in their schools for months. They're being dispersed all over the place because their buildings have been flooded out, and they simply just cannot quickly turn a switch and bring them back to where they know other people, and they know their teachers and all that stuff. So you can't send, let's say, 1,100 kids from one school into another building and expect that to work. I mean, people are making very valiant and great extemporaneous efforts to figure out creative spaces. I was out in Staten Island yesterday and the day before, and one of the principals in the high schools had set up the cafeteria and I guess the gym and some of the offices as classrooms for her own students in her own high school so that they could make room for younger children who were being shipped there from another school on Staten Island.
And it goes right up to the economic life of the city. I mean, we're hearing on NPR today, Morgan Stanley, Standard & Poor's, on and on. People just out of their offices, desperately looking for a dry place to do business.
It's a really stressful situation, I have to say. I covered Katrina. I was in New Orleans for a while, and obviously that was terrible, terrible losses of life there. But I don't think anyone has their arms yet around the extent of the property damage here and the disruption to the social fabric that's gone on.
And it goes on even now with this nor'easter coming through with its cold and rain and snow.
Yeah, you know, I almost feel like this is something you can brush off your shoulder. Fortunately, the winds were not as bad as had been predicted, and so I don't think there was a tremendously big additional burden on the power system. I know about another 30,000 people lost power, and I, you know, 30,000 customers, which can be, you know, four people in a house or an entire office building,
yep,
each one of those. So I don't mean to downplay it, but it did not turn into the million number that we had a week and a half ago.
Small mercy in the wake of Superstorm,
right,
Sandy. Jim Dwyer with the New York Times, thanks very much for joining us, Jim.
Okay, talk to you. Bye.
Okay, to the cities challenged and proposed new barriers to the sea, here's the sound of the water flooding in the streets of Lower Manhattan at the height of Hurricane Sandy. This is not what you want to hear in the streets of your major city. And living in that, no fun at all. Here's Armando Morales, New York, Lower East Sider, in an interview with Democracy Now! Describing his living conditions after Sandy.
We got no water. We got no electricity. Food is going to go bad. You know what I mean? We're working on trying to eat. No heat. It's cold. I'm trying to keep the place warm by lighting up the oven. But how long can you do that? You can't do that long. And I have to get buckets of water to keep cleaning things and doing that. And it's getting me out of help because I walking back up and forth. And then bathing, we can't bathe, there's no water. It's very bad for the people on the Lower East Side.
And that's no way to live in the country's biggest city. Andrew Cuomo, governor of the state of New York, talking here with NBC's Brian Williams, in a subway station flooded out by Hurricane Sandy, saying the state should consider a levee system or storm surge barriers.
I said kiddingly the other day, we have a 100-year flood now every 2 years, right? There is a frequency to this. And this is really a new problem for New York State. We have not seen a flood like this, damage like this, in our generation, period.
Given the scale of this storm, said Andrew Cuomo, governor of New York, he said, given the frequency of these extreme weather situations we have had, for us to sit here today and say this is once in a generation, it's not going to happen again, I think would be short-sighted. He's talking new barriers to the sea. With us right now is Malcolm Bowman, head of the Storm Surge Research Group at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, where he's professor of oceanography. He was a member of the New York City panel on climate change and has been an outspoken advocate of new physical protections for the city from the sea. Malcolm Bowman, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Paint a picture of what you'd like to see. If you could wave a wand and have it be there, what would it look like? What would it be?
For the last 8 years, I've been promoting the concept of what I call regional protection rather than piecemeal patching up vulnerable spots all around the city. We must do that, of course, but you get to a point where a major catastrophe overwhelms the city and a regional approach is really required. By that I mean storm surge barriers that would be, two storm surge barriers that would be located at key spots to hold back the surge from the sea for just those few hours during high tides when these surges are the most threat. So one would be in the Upper East River near Throgs Neck Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
To stop the surges from Long Island Sound. The second would be in the outer harbor between Sandy Hook, New Jersey, and Breezy Point, Long Island.
That's a big one. That's miles.
That's 5 miles, but there's a lot going for that location. The water is very shallow. It's only 20 to 25 feet deep, except for the navigation channel, the Ambrose Channel. It has the advantage that it would protect all of Manhattan, all of northern New Jersey, Staten Island, Port Elizabeth, the three major airports, Newark, LaGuardia, Kennedy, would protect the outer boroughs of southern Brooklyn and Queens, where 2 to 3 million people live less than 6 feet above sea level.
What would this thing look like, Malcolm? I mean, is this a giant wall that opens and closes, or the gates? What's it look like?
Now, it would look like an elevated highway. Let's talk about the Sandy Hook to Breezy Point.
5 miles or so.
5 miles would be like an elevated roadway. People familiar with the crossing over Chesapeake Bay or mm-hmm. Lake Pontchartrain mm-hmm. in New Orleans, it would be an elevated highway, basically. It could be a multipurpose interstate highway system, 4 lanes, bypass of New York City. It could have rail.
And under the highway, the rail, when the storm surge is coming in, what would happen? What's down there to block it?
Well, along the length of this 5-mile let's call it a causeway, would be vertical panels that would drop down to block the water from, which would normally flow underneath. So you can think of it like a guillotine coming down, a series of panels. And then in the center where the shipping channels are, there would be large swing gates, like large saloon doors that would close for the few hours to block that surge.
Wow. We've got video of what that might look like at our website, onpointradio.org. People are talking, what, maybe 15 billion, something like that? Is that a reasonable number?
That's a reasonable number. That's sort of back of the envelope. Dutch colleagues in Amsterdam, who are world authorities on storm barriers, under contract right now, with New York City, coming up with detailed estimates of what the cost would be, and that will be available shortly.
It's been done in Bangkok's doing it, Jakarta, New Orleans, of course, has it, Rotterdam, St. Petersburg. What about those who say, this is the wrong way to go here? Let's put in marshes, let's be resilient in our subway entrances, let's raise them, let's do it a little piece at a time.
We have to do all those little pieces at a time. It's very prudent. It's just like we look after our houses and our automobiles. We do the best we can to keep them in good condition. If in a storm a branch falls on a house and knocks off the guttering, what do? You fix it.
What about those who say, let's fix climate change, we can't armor the world?
Eventually, we'll put the question another way. How long do we want New York City in its present form to exist?
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about New York in the wake of Hurricane Sandy, looking at building barricades to the sea. Higher walls, barriers, super gates, and whether that's the right idea, the way to keep New York going. Here's a, well, we've all heard these, but just to keep in mind the cost when this water comes in, economic cost, the human cost. Yesterday on CNN, they were talking with a Staten Island resident whose house had been flooded, stripped down to the wooden beams, still reeling from Hurricane Sandy as a nor'easter headed his way.
Everything that I own is here, and I'm trying to save it. My wife, my kids, my best friend Mike, and I'm just going to lose everything. I mean, my body's shutting down. There's no words to explain or express the stress, the pain, the suffering.
Maybe he'd be glad for a wall, maybe not. Here's Luis de Corrales of Rockaway Beach describing what happened when the water gushed into his home.
Me being hard-headed, I didn't want to leave. Everything I own is in there. I'm 52 years old. And then before I knew it, the water came. The windows busted out and thousands of gallons of water came in, and within a matter of 30 seconds, I was up to my chest in water.
But super storm surge barriers, says the governor of New York, maybe not, said the mayor on November 2nd. Here's Michael Bloomberg questioning the need, the cost for expensive storm barriers.
When you have an enormous harbor like we do in Long Island Sound, even if you spent a fortune, it's not clear to me that you would get much value for it.
There, Malcolm Bowman is with us, head of Storm Surge Research Group at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He's been big in this conversation. With us right now as well from Philadelphia is Radley Horton, research scientist at the Center for Climate Systems Research, Earth Institute, Columbia University in New York, climate science lead for the science policy team of the New York City Panel on Climate Change. He's currently at a NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, meeting on climate risk in the urban Northeast. Pretty relevant meeting to be having. Radley Horton, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
There's Mayor Bloomberg saying on November 2nd, so here we are into storm time, not clear that you get much value for this huge series of barriers that Malcolm Bowman and others are talking about. Where do you come down on this? Is it time to look at this, to do it?
What I heard from the mayor and what I heard from those two harrowing remarks that we just heard is why we critically need to do this research. It may well be that it is the time for New York to build barriers such as this. But because the stakes are so high, it points to the need for us to move forward and consider all the different pros and cons and what would be an extremely intricate endeavor with you know, we need to make sure it'll work, for one thing.
Our listeners are responding immediately here on Facebook. Let me put this to you, if I may, Mr. Horton. Jamie says, not realistic at all. We need to design better cities that are actually aligned with natural systems. Building bigger walls is just like installing more sprinkler systems for green lawns in Arizona. You know, we need to pay attention to history, not delude ourselves that we can overpower nature. What do you say to that perspective, Radley?
I think we need a range of solutions. That's part of what we just heard there, not to put all our eggs in one basket. Now, we do need to think about the fact that New York City, you know, is such a densely populated area with so many valuable assets. It may be that such a barrier system makes sense here, but we need to look into other strategies as well, as we heard. Can green solutions, adding resiliency in marshes along the coast, give us extra protection? And a whole series of other strategies, elevating some of the critical equipment in basements, for example, of buildings.
So in lower Manhattan, it doesn't get flooded and what, broken down when the water comes in?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's absolutely.
Malcolm, I'm not sure that's what our listener is saying, range of solutions. I think our Jamie is saying, no, you can't do this. You can't overpower nature so walls don't make sense. But is that the lesson of history? I mean, there have been, the Dutch certainly have some history in pushing back water. Venice has some history. Others now are making it.
Look, philosophically, she's right. You should not, the foolish man built his house upon the sand. Mm. But New York City, we have this densely populated world center, and it's built on the water's edge. It's built at low elevations. What are you going to do? You're just going to move the city? That's unrealistic. I think we have to try and work with what we've got. And all those solutions that Radley talked about, that's all correct. The resilience, we have to repair the vulnerable spots as we go along. If you look at the European experience, it took 20, 25 years or more after a major calamity, after a major loss of life, after a loss of infrastructure, before the barrier systems in the Thames River, London, around the Netherlands, in Venice, Italy, and now St. Petersburg, Russia, it took a quarter of a century for these things to be completed. So, well, I'm not proposing we start pouring concrete next week, but mm-hmm. what we do need to do and what Congress needs to do is to request that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers do a sophisticated analysis of all the pros and cons of the solution of regional defense.
You know, we've got response online here from a listener saying, yeah, right, maybe 50 years ago. But now, this listener writes, we're broke. Says the question should be, when will they relocate Wall Street? I mean, you say that's out of the question, but is there a point, Malcolm, at which I don't know where Sea Rise is going to go. Is there a point at which relocation has to be on the table, of something at least?
Right. Well, if you look at the increase in carbon dioxide into the atmosphere from burning fossil fuels, the increase is worse than the worst case scenario by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's studies back in 2007. And so climate change is a reality. It's going to get worse. It's going to accelerate. It's not going to suddenly peak at the year 2100. But we have to ask the question, how long do we want New York City and other vulnerable cities to exist as we know it?
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, maybe 150 years from now, we're going to have to relocate, as your listener said. But what do we do in the meantime? These storms are going to become with increasing ferocity and increasing frequency, sea levels rising, and by the end of the century, we'll be 3 to 6 feet higher than it is now. So what are we going to do in the meantime? If you tell the Dutch to evacuate their country, half of which is below sea level, where are they going to go? They have nowhere to go. France, Belgium, Germany, they don't want 30 million Dutch people invading their countries, and so they stand and fight, and I think we have to stand and fight.
Wow. We've got listeners with pretty good oceanfront experience paying close attention here. Bill in Hull, Massachusetts. Bill, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Thanks
Hi.
For taking my call.
Yeah.
I live in Hull, a coastal community, very much like the Jersey Barrier Islands.
Low-lying, yep, and right on the water, yep.
I'm right on the water, and we got flooded last night. I had about 3 feet of seawater in the street in front of my house. There is a breakwater offshore right near where I live that was put up after the blizzard of 78, and it's a great-looking breakwater, but it has just been decimated by storms since 1978 and is now virtually useless. It doesn't stop anything.
So what do you think about New York City, what it ought to do or not?
I think New York City should certainly try to do something, and I certainly applaud the effort that your panelists are talking about. It would be quite costly, but it sounds like it would be very well engineered. But I have in the back of my mind this lingering quote from the Jeff Goldblum character in Jurassic Park, where he, when told that the dinosaurs couldn't reproduce, said, "The lack of humility in the face of nature is just staggering." I think that there is a sense that we can engineer our way out of some of these problems, and nature is going to find a way to batter the coastline, no matter what we put up. And, you know, it's a kind of a fatalistic observation, but I just feel there's probably nothing we can really do. When you have a storm like Sandy, there's nothing that would have stopped that from destroying Staten Island and lower Manhattan.
On the other hand, there's the country's biggest city and a real asset to the nation sitting right in the path of these storms coming with more frequency. You know, who wouldn't try to do something if they could? But point taken, Bill. Let me get one more from the coast. Salem, Massachusetts. Audrey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is Audrey. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you think?
I think that building a wall in New York and on the East Coast, is you're putting a Band-Aid over the situation. It's we should be investing this money into making drastic changes on our everyday lives and how we're going to change the CO2 emissions into the air. As much as a wall would be a temporary solution, like the previous caller said, nature's going to find a way, and sooner or later, we're just going to keep putting more and more Band-Aids on this problem, and we're not going to be able to catch up, and we're going to be in a lot of trouble. And I think that we need to focus more on how we're going to change this global warming situation around.
Audrey, I take your point, but in the meantime, there's a great big city, and what about other places that have done it? What about the Dutch? I mean, they've got a whole lot of their country protected by walls and barriers. Maybe we've got to think that way in old New Amsterdam.
Well, at some point, as much as walls are going to help, there is going to be a point in time where our climate is going to be so elevated and our climate is going to be so impacting nature that these things aren't going to work.
Audrey, we take your point, and I'll take it to Malcolm and Radley, but I want to bring an engineer. Let's talk to the Dutch here, right into our conversation from Rotterdam in the Netherlands right now. Piet Derke joins us. He's Director of Global Water Management at Arcadis. They helped build the barrier around New Orleans that protected it after Katrina, before Hurricane Isaac. Also working on storm barrier projects in Bangkok and Jakarta, which have seen major damage from big storms and flooding in recent years. Piet Derke, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So you hear the skepticism in our first callers about whether this kind of barrier can really be effective, whether you can keep up with rising seas. What do you say, Pete?
Well, I think it's good to be skeptic, and it's also good to study very carefully the different options and solutions that are available. I think what New York, first of all, would need is a plan. Let's make a plan. Let's have all the different options and compare them with each other, structural or non-structural, maybe with barriers or maybe without barriers, but at least make a plan and take decisions on that.
What do you imagine could be protected against here? If you go with something like Malcolm Bowman's been describing to us, big barrier beneath the Verrazano Bridge, across the strait there, another one between Sandy Hook and the Rockaway, more or less, 5 miles across there. How high a sea storm surge could be protected against?
Well, I think storm surge barriers definitely can be one of the elements in such a plan. In Holland, we call that a delta plan. Maybe you would call it a Hudson plan or a delta plan for New York, maybe. Mm-hmm. Levees, flood walls could be elements in that, but also giving space, more space to water and to nature, or make your buildings more resilient, or climate-proof your environment can also be elements of such a delta plan. So storm surge barriers can be an element in it, but they're not the only thing in it. You cannot just protect yourself with a barrier in the Verrazano Narrows alone.
No, I guess nobody's saying the only thing, but people are looking seriously at this now. Mayor Bloomberg's misgivings notwithstanding. Malcolm Bowman, I'll put the same question to you. How big was the surge in Sandy? How big a surge could a hypothetical storm surge barrier protect against, Malcolm?
Well, that depends how high you build them. But
that's what I mean.
The Dutch protect their cities against what they call a 1,000-year storm, a storm that's so serious, so extreme, it only is likely to happen once every 1,000 years. And beyond that, and Pete can talk about that. So the surge from Sandy was about another 12 feet above the high tide level. What happened last week was that the peak surge hit at high tide. It was also a full moon that gives us a spring tide. So if we had had barriers in place at the outer crossing I was talking about, in the Upper East River.
The Throgs Neck Bridge up there where Long Island comes down along Manhattan.
We could have protected all of Staten Island, all of New York City, southern New Jersey, the three airports. That they would have been protected because most of the damage was done by seawater, not by rainfall during Sandy, and so there was not massive flooding inside.
Radley Horton, look forward here. You're looking on today from Philadelphia, but look out 50, 100, 150 years. What do you think these such barriers would have to be designed to protect against? How much sea rise? If we saw 12 feet in Sandy, are we talking 15, 20, 25? What's feasible?
Here's what we know. We know we've had a foot of sea level rise in New York in the last century. We know we're going to have a minimum of about 2 feet this century. And we know that alone is going to roughly triple the frequency of the 1 in 10 year coastal flood event. We do expect that sea level rise to continue beyond 2100 as well as greenhouse gases build up. And you've raised the possibility as well of how storms themselves might change. In addition to that average sea level, that baseline getting higher, could storms strengthen as ocean temperatures warm? That's a major research area. We know that we had unusually warm waters off the coast of the Atlantic, about 5 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer than normal during the storm. They absolutely caused, you know, helped it strengthen. So that's something to look into. We also need to look at whether the trajectory, the path of some of these storms could change in the future as we see, say, melting of sea ice in the Arctic. There's some suggestion that that is weakening the normal pattern of winds from west to east that tend to push storms away from the coast and towards the east as they get as far north as New York. We didn't see that with this storm. One storm is a small data point, and we haven't had that many years of this reduced sea ice, but I'd say it's a critical research area whether we could see more of these types of harmful trajectories in the future.
So how many feet could New York feasibly protect against, and how does it stack up against the potential height that we're looking at over the next century?
Here's what I would say. You know, it's going to depend on the design, but what we can say for sure is that there are some unique geographical issues that a barrier in New York City would face. This barrier, that the 5-mile one, is going to be exposed to some serious ocean waves. Malcolm, as an oceanographer, could say this better than me, but I believe that the second highest wave reading that was recorded during Sandy was a buoy in the general area of where this barrier would be at something like 33 feet. Maybe a barrier can withstand it, but it points to the need for us to, we have to be sure. We have to come up with ways to test the reliability of such a system. And there's a fundamental challenge. How do you test the reliability of a system that almost by definition can't be tested because you're trying to protect against such a rare event? How do we make sure that we have the necessary redundancy? You know, is it the human? You know, there's the potential for human error. There's the potential for automated error if we rely on software. How do we get that maximum blend of reliability?
Pete Derka, in Rotterdam, can you build a barrier that would protect against a 33-foot surge?
Yeah, I guess so. And you should imagine, you don't necessarily have to stop the whole wave. It is not a problem if above a certain level you have a certain overtopping of your flood walls or levees or barriers. As long as you reduce the water levels behind it enough, you can allow for some overtopping. I don't think we should focus also too much only on the impact of climate change, because in the Netherlands we have built our flood protection system simply because we live in a very low-lying area with a lot of people and a lot of value at stake, and we need flood protection anyway, with or without climate change.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about New York in the wake of Hurricane Sandy, looking at building barricades to the sea, higher walls, barriers, super gates, and whether that's the right idea. With Malcolm Bowman, he's head of the Storm Surge Research Group at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, has worked a lot with New York City on this. Radley Horton is with us from Columbia University's Earth Institute and the Center for Climate Systems Research there. He also has worked a lot with the city. Pete Derka is with us from Rotterdam in the Netherlands, Director of Global Water Management at Arcadis. They've worked on systems all over the place, but Bangkok, Jakarta, and not least New Orleans. He's created a conceptual design for a barrier north of the Verrazano Bridge. You can see a video of that design at our website, onpointradio.org. We've got Robert calling from Enid, Oklahoma, well inland right now. But, Robert, what do you know about storms and surges? What have you seen, Robert?
Well, hi, Tom. I'm actually from Houston. I'm just traveling
Great.
To Oklahoma today.
Yeah.
But a couple years ago, the Houston-Galveston area went through Hurricane Ike.
Sure.
Galveston, of course, has a 16-mile seawall that was essentially topped by the 20-foot storm surge.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that seawall was basically built after the 1900 storm, which killed 6,000 people.
Yeah.
But putting that kind of investment just doesn't seem to work, and it may have actually caused more harm on the areas beyond the seawall on what's known as the Bolivar Peninsula. So it'd probably be a better idea to quit getting people to live on the coast.
Robert, let us pick it all up. Bradley Horton, let me come first to you on this issue of, here's Robert looking at 16 miles of seawall, it's overtopped, and you're sitting there thinking, what was that worth? What about that issue? And then what about the water that's pushed back by this wall or held back? It's got to go somewhere else. Yeah. Does it make it worse for people down on the Jersey Shore, people up along the shore of Long Island? Or does it put them deeper in harm's way?
Yeah, I agree with you. I heard a couple critical points in that call that need to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is that social justice issue. What about the people who live just outside of the barrier? Is there a risk of a higher surge as some of that water is displaced for those populations?
Mm-hmm.
And so there are going to be major issues there. It points to why you need to have all those communities at the table in the discussion. Another part of what I heard was the idea of whether the barrier could change some of the ecology in a way. Could it change the way sediments flow
mm-hmm.
In a way that might affect marshes and limit some other types of protection that you might get? That you might get as well. So those are some of the issues. And also the other point I wanted to make quickly is I also heard something about this, that the risk of a false sense of security. That's why we need to have a range of resilient strategies. If we're all banking on it working, and if most of the funds go towards that means of protection, are we not going to be taking other steps to protect against surges, but also against some of the other hazards we face, whether it's heat waves? Malcolm mentioned intense rainfall events. During Irene, we had very heavy rainfall. Is there a risk that if the barriers were to fail, some of that water, that rainwater, might get trapped behind a barrier? These may be surmountable issues. We may end up building the barriers, but they're exactly the types of questions that a big group of people needs to be talking about, and I think are and increasingly will be.
Malcolm Bowman, listeners on those fronts. Here, Michelle says, writes on Facebook, says, living in New Orleans makes this an issue I think about almost every day. One thing I know is that there are many other options besides seawalls. Need innovative strategies, not just to resort to seawalls. And Manuel, to Radley's point, writes, keeping water out will also keep water in. Remember rain and snow. What about that one first, Malcolm? If you put up these big walls, barriers, you've got all kinds of stuff flowing into New York Harbor. Does it get stuck and stinky in there?
You have to remember that these barriers would be operational for only perhaps 3 or 4 hours at a time at local high tide when the surge is at its peak. These are not permanent walls. These are not blocking the ocean. These are not inhibiting the natural flow of the tides. Of course, we have to maintain that. It's essential for the ecology of the harbor. It's essential for flushing out the pollutants from sewage and so forth. In terms of the long-term prospects, it's a bit like ourselves. We all know in the end. We're all going to die, but that doesn't mean to say that we shrivel up. We go and see doctors. We keep healthy. We eat the right foods.
Mm-hmm.
We look after our bodies. And we try and extend our own lives as long as we possibly can. And so this is a similar sort of thing. Nothing is forever. And eventually, New York City will have to think about moving away from the coast.
Seriously?
Bradley's point about the efficiency and the safety of the barriers is all quite true. The worst thing you could do would be to engineer a system that was inadequate, and that's what happened in New Orleans over the years. Those levees mm-hmm. were pathetic. They fell over. They collapsed. We're not talking about a series of walls. Go online, Google the Delta Project, the Netherlands. You will see what they've done. They've elevated highways, have nourished the natural sand dunes. Half the country is protected by natural sand dunes, and the other half through engineered structures. So it's a combination of solutions, but it must be done properly so that it does not engender a false sense of security. That would be the worst thing. In terms of the high costs, it's occurred to our research group that the outer harbor crossing could be a multi-purpose system. It would be an elevated
road and rail
highway.
And, yeah.
It could be a rail link between northern New Jersey and Long Island. It could be rapid rail to Kennedy Airport. There could be all those things. It could be toll roads that would help pay for this system.
Jessica writes to us. She says it's time to face the reality that we need a carbon tax to fund the infrastructure needs we face now. Who would pay for this? Would this be out of a federal kitty? Or what about a carbon tax, Malcolm?
Well, carbon tax is a very controversial topic. That puts a tax on fossil fuels that we burn in our cars, we heat our houses, we fly our airplanes.
But that's her point, I guess. Go after the source of some of this warming while you raise the money to address it.
Well, that's exactly right. In terms of climate change, this is a global issue. No matter what we do in the United States, it's a global problem, and all the nations, the industrialized nations of the world, have to come together and agree on what to do, and it's failed so far. The Kyoto Accord expires next year. It was an accord in name only. The developing countries of China and India were excluded because they had been left behind over the years. That's the issue, but we just cannot wait for the nations of the world to solve this problem.
Pete Durka, in Rotterdam, in the Netherlands, what about the scale of what other cities are doing? Bangkok, Jakarta, is it on a par with what New York would require? Is it smaller? Is it bigger?
Well, first of all, I would like to say I'm here in Rotterdam right now, approximately at 15 feet below sea level.
Yeah, and dry.
And I'm pretty comfortable, quiet, warm, and dry up here. So it really helps in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
Our country is living with these kind of flood protection measures now for a couple of centuries, and we simply cannot live without them, being so far about half of the country is below sea level. So mm-hmm. It's no debate. On the other hand, I would like to invite you, come over here and look. You won't find a single wall. The system is, as Malcolm just described, is a system of more or less natural structures combined with levees and a couple of storm surge barriers, but these are not walls. These are doors, big doors, mm-hmm. and basically the door is open. The door is always open, so the water comes in and out. Only in case of a major flood, in case of a storm surge, mm-hmm. the door will be closed.
We've got that video at our website. You can see that giant door swinging.
Mm-hmm. Sorry?
We've got that video at our website of the design of that giant swinging door for New York. But what about the scale of it compared to Bangkok or Jakarta? Trying to get a feeling for what other countries, big cities are doing.
Well, I don't think you can really compare them all, although, Bangkok, Jakarta, Ho Chi Minh City, Dhaka, you should imagine they're all under construction. Eh? They're not there yet. They're all estimated in the orders of magnitude of $10, $15, $20 billion. New Orleans, the federal budget for that was $14.5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
That was spent after Katrina, and fortunately we saw that it worked. Eh? After ISAC, I think New Orleans already has a good return on investment there, just with one hurricane.
Well, clearly Sandy is going to cost a lot for New York, and that's just one. Judy in Williamsburg, Virginia. Judy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. My question has to do with water displacement. If these walls go up, I live near the Chesapeake Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to be the recipient of all this water? Where is it going to go?
Let's ask. Here comes the storm surge. The gates close. The walls go up. And Malcolm Bowman, where does it go? Who gets hit?
I get this question all the time. The increase outside the outer borough, according to my calculations, would be about 6 inches over a period of some hours. You're not talking about, there's a huge ocean out there. This water is just going to spread out over the whole ocean. It's not going to affect one iota the sea level in Chesapeake Bay.
I mean, I'm in no position to doubt you, but I've been reading people saying all kinds of things about, 20% rises that flow off in other directions that end up inevitably bouncing into somebody else's shore.
No, that's all based on a lack of understanding of how the ocean works. I mean, the ocean is a vast, 71% of the world is covered in the ocean. A little surge in New York is not going to affect sea level, say, 20 miles from the city.
Radley, do you buy that? I mean, I'm looking here at Dr. Cole saying the New York Times today you could have about 20% more water on the other side of this barrier. That sounds like a lot to a layperson, Radley.
Yeah, if I'm thinking of the same article, it might have also mentioned roughly a foot of additional surge. That may be right, it may not. We need more research. But here's something I can say for sure. Even if it's just an inch or 2 inches,
mm-hmm.
That's going to pose a whole set of ethical and legal questions. Again, it may still make sense to move forward with the barriers, but we need to have everybody at the table. This is a critical discussion. It's about long-term adaptation, and long-term adaptation is about much more than climate. It's about the future that we all collectively want for our city. So everybody needs to be at the table as we discuss these issues, including, you know, everyone from environmental groups, local community groups, private sector, as you said earlier, who's going to fund this. We need national leadership on adaptation generally, whether it's coastal zoning policy, whether it's investments on the scale and in hard infrastructure.
We heard Mayor Bloomberg kind of skeptical there on November 2nd. Do you think he's softening up on this after Sandy's hit?
In terms of the
openness to considering this big investment in storm surge barriers for New York City, his city.
What I can say is that one of the main recommendations of the New York City panel on climate change that Malcolm and I were a part of was that these studies should be conducted, these feasibility studies. And that's what I heard in the mayor's comments, that this is something that needs more research. And I think given the vulnerability we see, if anything, that research will be fast-tracked. That would be my guess.
Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Robert is calling. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Ah, thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
We get hit by a lot of storms on the Outer Banks and Kitty Hawk, and wave action does a lot of damage in addition to storm. I'm curious whether artificial reefs have a place in a solution and that they also could provide some habitat for fishes and that sort of thing.
Malcolm Bowman, what about artificial reefs, a beard of marshland on the tip of Lower Manhattan I've seen described? What about that kind of thing and beyond?
Well, that's not going to work. That's not going to, stop the surge. This kind of thinking, I'm not saying that marsh is not a good idea. In fact, if you look at Louisiana and the loss of marshlands there, thousands of square miles due to channelizing the Mississippi River, it's a big problem. And certainly when you have vast areas of marshland like that properly nourished, that could have helped them a lot after Katrina or during Katrina. But New York City has 520 miles of coastline, and it's mainly bulkheaded. So you can't grow in those areas. Certainly on the south coast, this Long Island has 120 miles of exposed coastline to the Atlantic Ocean and those storms that Radley was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an area where those dunes can be nourished just as they do in the Netherlands and protected that way. So there are ways of protecting the natural barrier that's there, for that reason they're called barrier beaches. But we saw during Sandy that a new inlet was punched through on the south coast of Long Island. So it's a continual struggle.
Paul in Rockland, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, my concern is that, you know, we live on the earth. Our weather conditions are always going to be changing. A city wall that's meant to cover a certain part of New York is going to miss the next storm that hits 50 miles down. Coastline that you're talking about protecting goes all the way from Maine to Brownsville, Texas, and south of that. You know, we're dealing with nature, and I don't think global warming is part of this conversation. I think that maybe smaller scale solutions may be better. I mean, the U.S. faces about four major problems: hurricanes and floods, Tornado Alley, earthquakes.
But not every place on that big coast you're describing, Paul, has New York City sitting on it. I mean, we have over centuries now made a big investment in this particular great city. Does that make it worth a special protection or not?
Sure. If I could finish, the answer is no. And I think the guy in Kitty Hawk would agree. And I lived in Charleston. Mm-hmm. And I live in South Carolina. And a lot of people lived in New Orleans, and 6,000 people died down in the
bathtub,
the storm in Texas. But the other thing, which I didn't get to finish, is earthquakes. And where have we solved our natural problem?
Hey, Paul, you're beyond our range today, and I'm short of time. I've just got a minute here. Radley, what about this perspective? Look, nature's big. The earth is big. You can't, you know, protect the whole thing, and so live with it.
I'll take a part of that. There are going to be many coastlines that can't be protected with, say, storm surge barriers. We know off the coast of populous parts of Florida, it's not feasible to build a barrier. It can't be done. Increasingly, managed retreat from some of the coastlines is going to be more and more part of the discussion. So we need to be open to those kind of issues. I do think that there's a huge vulnerability to climate hazards now. It's going to grow in the future as we increase our greenhouse gas concentrations.
What's your guess 20 years from now? Will we have storm surge barriers around New York City? Radley?
That's a great question. I echo what Malcolm said. It takes that long to design them. I'm going to take a pass. I don't know. It's a good question. Good question.
What do you say, Malcolm? Is it inevitable given the concentration of people and everything else that goes on there? Are they coming?
I believe it is. We have to deal with the problem that's been thrown at us. I'm all for natural solutions, but, you know, we're not going to go back to the Stone Age and living in caves. We have this industrialized, complex, sophisticated society that's becoming increasingly fragile as the furies of nature attack it.
Malcolm Brown, Radley Horton, Pete Durka, with that, we're out of time. But thanks to you all. This is On Point.